You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Keely Boltina. Coming up, our guest says we're watching the world through different lenses as Republicans and Democrats. So how do we take a closer look at the full picture? That's next.
Now, anyone who hoped to know presidential results last night or even this morning were likely disappointed.
Yeah, while only a handful of states have still not been called for either candidate, the current margins are close enough that the whole shebang can't be called just yet.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you expect the presidential race to be this close in Wisconsin? What about across the country? Did you or anyone you know change which party they voted for in the presidential race since 2016? What caused that switch? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org.
Laura Brown is an associate professor and the director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. She's the author of multiple books, including her most recent, Amateur Hour, Presidential Character and the Question of Leadership. And she's our guest now. Laura, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on today.
The election results are trickling out slowly, and yet things change very quickly. So let's start with what we know right now. Which states have not been called for either Trump or Biden?
Sure. So Arizona is a little uncertain in the sense that some organizations have called it, others have not, but it is certainly leaning toward the former Vice President Joe Biden. And there are some absentee ballots that have yet to be counted. We expect those to be counted a little bit later today and some news later this evening. We still have Georgia that has yet to be counted fully. There are absentee ballots, especially coming from counties around Atlanta that have not yet processed all of their absentee ballots. And those are still outstanding. That state, I would say, is truly a toss-up. It looks like it's on the knife's edge for one party or the other. North Carolina, the president is currently leading in. There are not as many states left, ballots left to be counted in that state, but there are still certainly enough that it is creating some uncertainty there. And then Nevada, that is, again, leaning toward the former vice president, and yet there are still ballots left to count. And then the big one, which sort of everyone's waiting for, is really Pennsylvania, where there are more than a million estimated ballots left to be counted. And while the president is currently leading in the vote count, those absentee ballots are mostly coming from the Philadelphia and Pittsburgh cities. And so we anticipate they will be heavily for the former vice president. And as a result, it looks likely at the moment that Pennsylvania could go toward Biden.
So each candidate is looking for those 270 electoral college votes needed to win. And Pennsylvania is a big piece of it. So, though, was Wisconsin, and Wisconsin did go for Biden. How big of a deal is that for either candidate?
Well, I think it's a very big deal. What we've seen in the last few hours is that Wisconsin was called for Biden, and so too was Michigan. And what this tells us is that the former vice president did a good job in rebuilding that blue wall that essentially had Democratic voters voting for Donald Trump in 2016. Those were states that he took by the narrowest of margins, and it appears as though they have now trended back toward the Democratic camp. And that's really all Biden needed to win. But I think it is interesting that we see these changes in Arizona and potentially these changes in Georgia. It speaks to a very different future for the Democratic Party going forward.
Say more about that. What do you mean?
Well, I think one of the things that is so interesting is that North Carolina and Georgia were much more Republican states in the last election. They appear to be sort of trending Democratic and trending that way substantially, partly because those states have populations that are growing, not just in terms of immigrants, but also in terms of migrants, meaning Americans that are moving to those states from other states. And the next time that we actually have a presidential election, it is likely that both Georgia and North Carolina and Florida will in fact have more electoral votes, not fewer, because we are headed into a reapportionment year where the census will change the number of House seats in each state, and that will in turn change the relative weight of the states within the Electoral College.
Sure, definitely. And we should note that the Washington Post, New York Times calling Michigan for Biden. AP is what NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio use, and it doesn't look like AP has made that determination quite yet. We're talking with Laura Brown, who's director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. We're taking stock of where we are as we process what's happening in our presidential election. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR2. We've got Nancy in Minocqua on the line. Hi, Nancy.
Hello.
What's on your mind? Great. Thank you.
Well, I just wanted to say in 2012, I voted Republican. And I switched in 2016 to the Green Party because I didn't like either candidate. And this year I went with Biden because I just got so tired of all of the bullying and all the lies that Trump was spouting out everywhere. And I didn't think that he handled the coronavirus at all for the people of America.
Nancy, thanks for your perspective on that. And Laura, Nancy saying, I voted for a third party candidate last time around when this president won. And now she switched, you know. That is part of one of the factors here that we're dealing with as we watch states go for one candidate or the other.
So that's right. I mean, let me just say that Nancy is completely, I think, typical of many Americans who, when they look at the two political parties, are not thrilled by either party's kind of ideological commitments or kind of vitriolic and acrimonious kind of combat that they get into with each other. And one of the things that we have seen over time is that many people have said that they consider themselves to be independents. And when you believe that an election is not going to turn on your vote, then you tend to see this independent or third party vote increase. And it's significant that in 2016, 6% of the electorate voted third party or independent candidate. That's not a small amount. It is also what kept Hillary Clinton below that majority level. And that's partly why we saw this change with the Electoral College and the popular vote winner.
Well, I mean, you mentioned that 4 years ago, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. Donald Trump won the Electoral College and therefore the presidency. We know that Joe Biden has garnered more votes than any other presidential candidate. Could that be the case again here with this split?
I don't think so. I think what we are headed toward is that he will be both a popular vote majority president as well as a majority of the states president. One of the things we have to realize is that when a candidate does not earn over that 50% mark, it is not completely unheard of. In fact, when candidates earn 48% of the vote, we've seen three times since 1860 that the Electoral College, that's when it inverts. And really, if you think about it, it's because if you only win 48% of the popular vote, it means that 52% of the electorate voted against you. So what is interesting about where we are is that, in 2016, Donald Trump, though he did not win the popular vote, he won the majority of states. And now we are going to, I think, be headed toward an election where the winner will have won both. And the Electoral College will follow that.
I want to welcome now Samantha in Whitehall to our discussion about presidential candidates. Hi, Samantha.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have voted since I was 18. I'm 39 now, and I voted Republican every time because of the stance of their, against the abortion. And the Democrats are you know, I believe are for, you know, abortion, the right to choose, and that's, you know, one of the big stance. And I have a friend that is a big Democrat, but the only thing that he has a problem with is her stance on the abortion. I said, that should be the number one thing you think of before you vote for anybody.
Interesting. So, Samantha, yeah, I want to jump in here because I want Laura to be able to respond, because Samantha, our second caller, thanks for calling in, different than Nancy, because Samantha's saying, this is my number one issue. I vote based on this issue. And we do know that there are voters that will decide on one issue and they will consistently vote based only on that. How does that play into our presidential politics?
Well, it certainly does. And this is where you see that the parties, in terms of their actual base of support, has been more consistent over time, because what you basically see is that people who are committed to a set of platform ideas on one side or the other are going to stick with that party because they know that that party articulates their viewpoint. What is true is that when you go back to the 1990s in this country, we had many more kind of cross pressures with regard to partisans who held different policy views. Over the last 25 years, we've seen essentially the policy views and the partisanship align. And that is partly why there's so much kind of polarization in our country, because there's much more rigidity. But when you actually go back to the 1990s, we did see sort of pro-life Democrats, and we actually saw some pro-choice Republicans.
We're looking at what we do and don't know about the results for our presidential election with Laura Brown. She's the director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. She's also an associate professor there.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you expect to wake up to final results this morning, or even to have them before heading to bed last night? The expectations were we would not. Do you feel like it's a good sign that the process is deliberate, that votes are being counted over time? Are you happy with the way the process is working? What do you think about the results you've seen so far? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org.
This conversation continues here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Keely Boltina. Right now we're talking with Laura Brown about what we know and what we don't know when it comes to results for our presidential election. She is an associate professor at George Washington University and the director of the Graduate School of Political Management.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about what's going on so far, what you've seen, and your reactions to the vote counts that are in. Call 800-642-1234.
And we've got Tom from Madison on the line who wants to join the conversation. Hi, Tom.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm concerned about the Electoral College. As it stands now, almost every state that has a huge majority in one candidate or another are disenfranchised. For instance, if California wins by, let's just say there's 10 million votes in California, 5 million votes, if only 2 million votes go one way and 8 million votes go the other way, they get 55.
Yeah.
Electoral votes.
Yeah, Tom, we get you there, because it seems like maybe in these big states with the Electoral College, Tom is pointing out that it might feel like your vote doesn't matter as much, especially if you are not, you know, the prevailing opinion here. What about the Electoral College, Laura? It comes up every time.
It does come up every time, especially when our elections are this close. So let me just say that how we get to a state's electoral vote allocation is the combination of how many House seats that state has, and then obviously each state has two senators. So California is weighted for its population. It has 53 House seats, which means it gets 53 of its electoral votes from its large population. Two, it then also gets for its senators. So it has a total of 55. But I always think that it's important to recognize that the problem with this sort of not being counted is actually a bigger problem of how states allocate their electors rather than it is the Electoral College itself. So, for instance, in every state except for Maine and Nebraska, the state allocates those electors in a winner-take-all fashion. If, in fact, those electors were allocated proportionally, what you would actually see is that whatever the popular vote was in the state is about the proportion of electoral votes that that party would get. And in fact, those two things would align, and it would force the candidates to, in fact, campaign in most states because they would be interested in kind of running up the margin in some states just to get one or two more electoral votes. We don't do that because the political parties actually don't really want a competition across the entire country. The cost of that is extraordinary, and it is also kind of difficult to do. And if you really look back to when all of this changed, it changed beginning in 1800 with the battle between Thomas Jefferson and John Adams.
Yeah, so there's quite a long history there of this sort of divide here. Talking to Laura Brown, who's director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University, and we're putting the presidential election into some context here as we watch the results come in today, tomorrow, as long as it takes. We've got Jenny from Weston on the line now. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. Question is, now that we're all done getting the actual votes in, how much do we really need to worry about one party or another, like what President Trump is stating now, you know, kind of questioning Pennsylvania and questioning those absentee votes and how long you can count them?
Jenny, thanks for the question. Laura, what do you think?
Well, so let me just say this. I really think we have to take a step back from where we are and kind of celebrate actually what we've done. At this point in time, less than 24 hours from all of the polls being closed, we have now counted over or nearly 140 million ballots. That is kind of extraordinary when you think about it. Over 100 million Americans cast their ballot prior to Election Day via an absentee or mail ballot. It is really extraordinary what we've done. And what we're really looking at is that there are essentially a couple million ballots across a handful of states that just have yet to be counted. They were in fact already cast and they just need to complete those counts so that the states can have a total of where things are. I would honestly say that I am disheartened when I hear sort of the president talking about the idea that these votes just sort of show up in some, you know, potentially or allegedly fraudulent way. That's not the way this is. And we are completely within the realm of what is normal for counting ballots. Even if we just kind of remind ourselves back to 2000, we spent more than 30 days trying to sort out the ballots in Florida. Spending, you know, 48 hours is just not something to be worried about.
Well, and so that's one aspect of it. There's also this piece that involves the U.S. Postal Service. Yesterday, a U.S. district judge ordered the USPS to conduct a ballot sweep in 12 postal processing facilities covering 15 states. What happened here and why are we talking about it right now?
Well, I mean, we're engaged in this conversation because it has come out that there have been 300,000 ballots nationwide that were entered into the post office system, but were not sort of scanned to show that they were received by these election officials. And in many states, including most of the states that are still being contested, there is a requirement that ballots must not only be cast before Election Day, but in fact received on Election Day. So there is some question about what is the remedy for this? Was there a potential disenfranchisement of 300,000 people who believe they cast their ballots? And was this the fault of the post office? And was that fault perhaps intentional? There are a lot of questions for the court to sort out. But I do think, and I think it's important to realize, that the courts have consistently sided with the voters as we have approached this election season. We just had a court case in Texas where they basically said, look, it didn't matter that these ballots were cast by drive-through. That was a problem of the election administration. You still need to count those more than 127,000 ballots. And this is really heartening because at the end of the day, the courts do want the votes to count, and everybody who's involved in a campaign should want their voters to have their votes counted.
Laura, we're paying attention, of course, to what's happening right now. Thank you so much for joining us at this stage of the game.
Absolutely. A delight to be on this afternoon.
Laura Brown is an associate professor and the director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. She's the author of multiple books, including the most recent called Amateur Hour, Presidential Character, and the Question of Leadership. And she joined us for the latest on the presidential election.
As votes in the presidential election continue to be counted, we're reporting on developments. Join us tonight at 8 for an NPR election update special with the latest news from around the country here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Also follow developments, including Wisconsin election results, at WPR.org.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll welcome a couple of former state lawmakers, a Democrat and a Republican, to talk about the state legislature as well as Congress and the presidency.
Now, even if we don't know the final election results yet, one thing is clear on both local and national levels. Politically, we're pretty divided. An us versus them mentality has taken over for people.
Our next guest has spent a lot of time talking to Americans about their political views and their views of those of the opposite party. One thing she's found, what we perceive to be true about each other is often not reality.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you connected with someone with different political views? Do you agree that our perception of the other party is not always accurate? Do you think we can find some common ground after all of this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@WPR.org.
Amanda Ripley is a contributing writer at The Atlantic. Her books include The Unthinkable, Who Survives When Disaster Strikes, and Why. Her upcoming book is about how people can get over seemingly intractable conflicts. She joins us now to talk about how we can find some common ground after the election, the long run up to it, and the aftermath. Amanda, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we talked before the election, Amanda, about fears and hopes running up to Election Day. The day itself, in most respects, went pretty smoothly without a lot of conflict, high conflict or otherwise.
That's right. Thank goodness that we did not see widespread violence. We actually saw very manageable lines in most places. The system worked well. People behaved well. And that's what I sort of expected. Really, the highest risk moment for us begins now and for at least the next 2 weeks. We know that the sporadic violence that occurred after the 2016 election was in the 2 weeks after the election. And around the world, about 1 in 5 elections becomes violent. And it's usually after the election, not necessarily the day of. So this is the moment when we have to be particularly careful and thoughtful about the rhetoric we use and the way we treat one another.
And as we watch, some states still being counted, which is fine and working normally, but challenges to that right now from the Trump campaign. We don't know who the winner is going to be as these votes get counted. But the Trump campaign definitely vocally challenging the legitimacy of the counting in some of these states. Is that something that worries you?
Yes, and I expected it. So, this president has been very clear about his intention to challenged the integrity of this election for months now, and he's in many ways very predictable, right? Like, even though he's very different than any president we've ever had, his behavior is quite predictable. So it is definitely the time for regular people, the exhausted majority of Americans who are fed up with extreme rhetoric, with division, with fighting. Those people, now is the time for you to speak up, to call for peace and for a free and fair election and a peaceful transfer of power, to write your, you know, local media outlets, to post on Facebook, to remind all of us that we are all Americans and we are all neighbors. And whether we like it or not, we are married to each other and we can get divorced, but we still have kids together. So we need to work it out.
And you mentioned Facebook, and social media is going to be the place. I haven't watched closely. I know there is a lot of misinformation going on around there, a lot of people trying to stoke confusion and dissent with the results. Does it make a difference if people go on and make a point of sharing positive posts and talking about their faith in the American people when there's all that other stuff out there?
Right. No, this is the amazing thing. Like, the research shows it actually does make a difference. So violent rhetoric incites violence and peaceful rhetoric incites peace. Like, it sounds kind of naive, but the research on this is actually very convincing, that if you make it not cool to call names and to divide and to, you know, just kind of use vitriol and certainly to use violence, then people are much less likely to do it. You know, one of the things we forget is that mostly what people want is to belong. Like, people are frightened of the other side for lots of reasons, and they are worried about the future, and they want to fit into their community, and they feel very disconnected for lots of reasons, including the pandemic. And if you make it clear that this is not cool, this kind of language, calling each other names and remind everyone that we are all Americans, we know from the research this actually does have a calming effect. So that and it doesn't, I mean, it would be great if the president did it, right? But it doesn't have to be a famous person. Like, you can have that same impact in your own network.
Talking to Amanda Ripley about how to help overcome divisions in the United States on and about Election Day. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you part of that exhausted middle in the United States? You're tired of the shouting you see from one or from both sides of the political spectrum. Do you think it's worth speaking out and saying, hey, let's be calm and, you know, go with this process that seems to be working pretty well so far? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Paul is with us in Minnesota. Paul, hi.
Hi. I just think the sooner we all realize that we're just all human beings and there is no other group, the better off we'll be. You know, people calling Trump supporters racist and this and that don't do no good. You know, we're human beings, and that's all we are.
Paul, thanks a lot for the call. And, Paul, that dovetails, Amanda, into something that you wrote just in the last couple of days. It was put out there about how people on either side of the partisan divide really overgeneralize about the other side. I think you used the word that they have cartoonish perceptions of people on the other side of the political spectrum. What kind of things do you see?
So, for example, Democrats think Republicans are much richer, older, and more extreme in their views than they actually are. And Republicans, on average, think that Democrats are much more godless than they are, that they are, that a much greater proportion of them are gay than they actually are. Like, here's the facts, to Paul's point. Americans are not as wildly different as their leaders seem to be, as the extremists on social media are. Most Republicans are middle class, straight and white, and guess what? So are most Democrats. So there's a lot of things that we have been kind of nudged into believing about each other and about our differences. And, you know, this is sometimes for me, it's really helpful to look at how countries get divided far away from us, like other countries, Because when I look at, like, you know, Poland or Venezuela or Italy or other countries that have elected and fought over sort of presidents and leaders like Trump and gotten very polarized, I don't immediately assume that half of that country is inherently evil, right? I assume that they are being manipulated by their leaders and that there's other problems going on that are systemic that have to do with inequality and hope and fear and suffering, right? So it may be true that the outcome is evil, right? That some of the policies that get put into action are hurtful and people do suffer. But the reasons why that happens at scale, when you're talking about millions of people, are complicated.
Another data point you share in that piece I mentioned was when you asked people in surveys what they think of political violence, is it okay? Would it be okay in certain circumstances for your side to use violence in a political, effort? And do you think that the other side is likely to use violence? You find some really interesting stuff. What do we see in that kind of survey question?
Yeah, this is research by the nonpartisan organization More in Common that was conducted last month. And they asked, Republicans, if Joe Biden appears to win this election, but President Trump claims it was stolen, would you condone physical attacks against Biden supporters? And in fact, only 3% of them said yes, they would. But when Democrats were asked to guess how Republicans would respond, they predicted that 49% of Republicans would in fact condone physical attacks. And interestingly, the reverse scenario is the same, pretty much. Like when Democrats were asked how they would respond if Trump appears to win and Biden claims the election was stolen, only 4% said they'd condone physical attacks. But here again, Republicans guessed that 52% of Democrats would justify physical attacks. And we're at a point where when I write this in the Washington Post, you know, I think there were 500 comments and about 400 of them were people saying, but that's because Republicans are violent and we're not violent. And you can't even present the results without triggering people who write comments. Right. Now, it's important to note, though, that if you took five Americans at random, one of them is the kind of person who writes comments, who's posting on social media a lot, who's, you know, politically very, very engaged. These are the extremists. Right. And they sometimes are very important, but right now they are having a disproportionate and distortionary effect on this election and on our public discourse. So 4 out of 5 Americans are much more sort of reasonable, open-minded, less extreme in their rhetoric and the way that they demonize the other side. So then again, I come back to this idea that we need to hear from those 4 out of 5, and we need to, in the media, raise up those voices.
Amanda Ripley is with us, contributing writer at The Atlantic. Her forthcoming book is about how people can escape intractable conflicts. We're talking about the division we've felt this election season, how we might be able to come together afterward.
And you're part of this conversation. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. Have you connected with someone who has different political views than you do? Do you think we can find some common ground? Do you have some ideas about how we can make it happen? Call 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Keeley Boltina. We're continuing our conversation with Amanda Ripley, who's a contributing writer to The Atlantic. She's also written several books, including a forthcoming book about how people can resolve difficult conflicts.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel the division in your community, in your family? Have you found ways to work through it? Call 800-642-1234. I want to give a listen to an instance of two maybe unlikely people coming together, two candidates for governor running against each other. They appeared here together in campaign ads in the state of Utah. Here's a listen.
I'm Chris Peterson.
And I'm Spencer Cox.
We are currently in the final days of campaigning against each other to be your next governor.
And while I think you should vote for me.
Yeah, but really you should vote for me.
There are some things we both agree on.
We can debate issues without degrading each other's character.
We can disagree without hating each other.
And win or lose, in Utah, we work together.
So let's show the country that there's a better way.
My name's Chris Peterson.
And I'm Spencer Cox.
And
we approve this message.
not something you see every day, Amanda, but is this the sort of thing that can make a difference?
Yeah, what's interesting is these guys did these ads and they went viral online. You know, it really took off, and which I think shows you how hungry most Americans are for something different than what we've got. You know, I think a lot of us in the media tend to think that, you know, conflict is what gets people's attention. But at this point, conflict is really cliche, right? Like, people are just exhausted by it. So when you have something different, that actually surprises people. It gives people hope. And that can get a huge amount of attention. So I do think, despite everything, there is a huge opportunity here for media outlets, for politicians, for all of us to do something very different. It takes people by surprise, and it makes them feel less hopeless. And we can really turn around what the norms are for what's acceptable. So that governor's race is a great example. It ended up that Spencer Cox, the Republican, won that election quite dramatically, but he has already said that he would like to work with his opponent in his administration. And I have every reason to believe that he's telling the truth. They seem to genuinely like each other, and they didn't know each other before the campaign. So that's, you know, that's extremely unusual these days, but proof that it is possible and that people want it.
To that, we asked people on the Ideas Network Facebook page what they think it would take to overcome polarization. Beth wrote, maybe save our criticisms for the politicians and speak too about voters on the opposing side as we would if we were face to face. There's a lot of fear and anger, but I'm praying a calmer tone will at least give us the time and energy to resolve our own feelings. This has been emotionally exhausting. Americans are spent. Beth says we need a vacation. Beth, not alone, I'm guessing, Amanda.
Yeah, I love that. And I love the idea of treating the politicians differently and expecting different things from them than you might treat your neighbors and people you disagree with. One of the things that I really try to do, I don't always succeed, but I feel like my only role anymore as a journalist is to try to revive curiosity in a time of false simplicity. So I spend a lot of time listening to understand people with whom I really disagree. It is okay to disagree with someone and still be curious to understand how they got where they are. It's not only okay, but I think it's our only way out of this thing. You know, at this point, at this level of conflict, our brains behave differently. So emotions matter way more than, you know, any number of leaked documents or congressional reports or newspaper articles. Emotions are everything. And so when you're dealing with a highly emotional situation, you have to act differently, or you're just going to keep getting the same result.
Talking to Amanda Ripley about divisions in the United States and how to help work through them, or at least coexist with them. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on Diane calling from Oregon. Diane, hi.
Hi there. I want to say that I think that it's urgent that people, first of all, that they not abandon each other in very personal ways. And what I mean by that is I know people who feel that they just can't keep being friends with people that are of the other party, for example. And it does tend to happen that people that I interact with socially at different levels, there is a separation that's been paralleling the political divide that happens as well. And I think it's urgent that people speak with each other and not abandon each other, because I believe that there's American values and that there's values, you know. And when I say as an example, I might say to a friend who's of the other party, are you really okay with the fact that he didn't pay any taxes for 10 years, zero? Are you really okay with the fact that, actually, the one I can hardly speak about is that there's over 500 children at the border that we have separated?
Diane, I got your point. We only have a few minutes left. To Diane's original point there, Amanda, of trying not to abandon people even when there are fundamental disagreements about a political issue or a political figure.
I love that, and I think, you know, that is the courageous thing now. You know, there's something like 38 million Americans stopped talking to a family member or friend because of the 2016 election. We can assume it's probably more this time around. And we see where that got us, right? Like, I don't think that led anyone to change their minds. It led people to dig in. It's difficult. Like, I'm not going to lie. And if you don't feel safe in having a conversation with someone, then you shouldn't have it, right? And some people are just not curious at all. They don't want to hear what you have to say. And they're just kind of going to bully their way through the conversation. But there are a lot of ways to have these conversations that can be really productive. And you have to open yourself up to, before you even start, acknowledging that you don't know everything, right? And that we're all mortals, and that we're all trying to make our way through this world, and try to understand, how is it that someone that I know and like in other ways can come to such a radically different conclusion, and get really curious about that.
Thanks for the call. We'll bring on Steve now in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Well, someone recently told me this, so maybe my opinion doesn't matter. I'm a cis white male who's old, who's about to die, so my opinion doesn't matter. That's a true quote that happened yesterday. But we're not going to have any type of unity with a media that's so disconnected. One of the things Trump is right about, we have fake media, but I would call it biased. And the disconnect and seeing how close this election was, especially if you take California out of the mix and then look at the media and how they treated people who are Republicans, there is a complete disconnect. And until that changes, and there is curiosity, which isn't curiosity right now by the media, we're going to have division and hatred.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Whatever thoughts on media bias, Amanda, you think a lot about how the media can be in touch with people from different points of view and different communities, and you see a lot of room, I think, for improvement.
I do. I think there is a way to do this that does revive curiosity. I think there are individual journalists who are doing that and stations that do it much more than others, including this one. I think that it's not just a problem on the left. I think that the president has repeatedly demonized the media. I have friends of mine who are just trying to cover the White House, who have been, their lives have been threatened. They've been frightened for their children. That is not how a democracy works. So while I agree that there have been a lot of problems with the way that journalism has operated for decades, predating President Trump, the solution is not to then demonize and name call reporters. Most of them are, the mistakes they make, they are not aware of them, right? They're not actually trying to destroy the country, to the contrary. So a lot of what I think some, particularly local news outlets, are doing is to try to change what they do, to try to really listen to their audiences, to their community, to try to become more like partners with the people they serve, as opposed to, somebody who's speaking to them from on high. There's something called the Trusting News Project that works on this. Harkin is another one. And there's some very cool things that are happening. Unfortunately, they're typically not happening at the national level yet. But just like with politics, I think this one's going to have to start at the local level.
30 seconds left. Amanda, leave us with a little encouragement.
You know, I think, look, This country is full of people of goodwill who do not want to live at each other's throats any longer. You hear, we talked about those candidates for governor in Utah. Those people are running against each other in a system that is designed to make them hate each other, and yet they rejected that. You know, we need to develop a culture, a counterculture that's not as adversarial, that really embraces something very different. And now is definitely the time to go on to Facebook if you use it, or write your local media outlets and say, enough is enough. We need to start treating each other with decency and dignity, even as we continue to disagree about very important things.
Amanda, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks for having me, Rob. Take care.
You too. That's Amanda Ripley, contributing writer at The Atlantic. Her books include The Unthinkable, Who Survives When Disaster Strikes, and Why. We've been talking about overcoming division. She's got a piece in The Washington Post. We've created cartoonish narratives about people in the opposite party. It's up at WPR.org/Central Time.
Looking ahead, from 6 to 9 o'clock, it's the morning show tomorrow. Bright and early, learn about the latest report on air quality trends here in Wisconsin. That starts at 6 in the morning.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.